They were ready.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
They look so poised and lovely, but I know those aren't comfortable seats to sit in, so decided to give them a break. After the resurrection, the laundry. That was my title for this week. And what I wanted to talk about, there's an ancient Zen saying, before the Enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After the Enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. And last week was Easter. It was a long weekend. The kids were off school. It was a long weekend for the kids. I'm sure it was a longer weekend for the parents. And we had this wonderful celebration here at the church, the choir, the cello playing, 39 kids here last Sunday, the Easter Bunny. And I'm sure many of you went home and polished off some ham and some deviled eggs and even got into some Easter baskets and stole some chocolate. And all this on one day, April 16th, and you know what happened on April 17th? Not a thing. Yeah, exactly. Kids went back to school, we went back to work, spiritual highs behind, and before us, work, chores, rest, repeat. Hopefully you get the rest part before you repeat. And that is life. That's life after any big life experience, whether it's a good experience, a resurrection experience, or whether it's a death experience, or whether it's just a period of really increased activity. As Ellen talked about last week, whenever we have been through any kind of loss, that is our crucifixion. Any kind of hard times, any kind of uncertainty, and then we have our hallway experience, that 3 days in the tomb, when we don't know what was happening in there, we know what happens with us. We sit there waiting and going, why don't I know what's happening next? Why do I feel so awful? Isn't there something I could do? That's my response, is there must be something I can do. Get really, really, really busy. But the busyness doesn't really work if it's not time to move on. And so the resurrection does come. And when the resurrection comes, we see the world in a completely new way. We're like, oh, everything is completely different. Everything I see is different. Everyone I know is different. Everything is different. And the laundry needs to be done. And my husband still won't pick up his muddy shoes or take off his muddy shoes before he tramps through the whole house I just vacuumed. And the dog still needs to be bathed. And on and on and on and on. And it's really easy to sort of lose that high. And even if you haven't had a spiritual high recently, life tends to be kind of roller coastery. You know, we have these long, slow ascents sometimes, followed by these really, really quick and deep and long descents. And a lot of the time in between is either anticipation or disappointment or just waiting. Just waiting. And I know that for me, it's not just highs. It's in times of true crisis. If there's a crisis going on, I am good. I feel confident that I could do an emergency tracheotomy if you needed one. I keep a cool head when the crisis is on. It's when everything is fine that I'm most likely to go crazy. That's what I find about myself. It's fine. It's not great. It's not bad. It's fine. Fine, I don't do so well. So even when we're being transformed by the fire and we come out of that experience and we're happy that we're not so sad anymore or that things aren't so hard anymore, there's still that element of, okay, well, yawn. It's easy to fall back asleep after any kind of awakening, any kind of resurrection, any kind of change. It's easy to fall back asleep. And Easter is the week after Easter is traditionally the lowest attended Sunday in the church here, at every church everywhere. It's like the people who don't come to church at all get up the energy to get there Easter morning, and they're like, whew, that was hard. Next year, we'll do it again. And sometimes what I think, what I see, what I observe people do, and I think I used to do, I probably still do some, but I know that I used to do it quite a bit, was when there wasn't any drama, I would just find some. I would either find someone who had some and, you know, glom onto them, or I would manufacture some in some way, like walking into my husband when everything's perfectly fine and saying, let's talk. You ever done that one? You're just asking for it. So any period of heightened activity can be followed by this sort of blah. And what is it that we want when we're blah? Do we want bliss? I don't know that bliss is a sustainable state. But having joy daily, I think that is attainable for every single one of us. Daily joy. Bring it on. And that's what the Buddha had. And I'm specifically talking about some Eastern concepts this week because I know you've had a lot of Jesus in the past couple of weeks. And I'm giving you a break. I'm giving Tommy Potts a break from the Bible degook. I have to tease him about that. It's my favorite new word, Bible degook. So the Buddha had that joy. He had that way of approaching life. And when people came to him and said, "What are you?" You know, they saw him never losing his composure and remaining in compassion and having so much joy. I just love that the Buddha got fat when he got old. He enjoyed life. He enjoyed things. He sat under the Bodhi tree and he got enlightenment, but then he went, "What good is this if I sit here and keep it to myself?" And he made, as a bodhisattva, he made the decision to take what he had learned and be, the story is that he could have just achieved nirvana, but he made the decision to pass on his teachings to others so that they might attain what he had attained. And it seems like he had a really good time while he was doing it. I love that. And people said, "What are you? Are you a god? Are you a deity? Are you a guru? Are you a..." And he refused to say what he was other than to say, "I am awake. I am awake." And I think that's what we have to watch for, is our tendency to fall back asleep. And I love that he used the word awake, because awake means that's something all of us can do. You know, you're asleep, you wake up. It's completely attainable. It's not some unattainable goal that's on some lofty mountaintop in the Himalayas. It's attainable. You can wake up. You all woke up this morning in one way. We can all awaken. And so for me, that awakening is about mindfulness. And this is what the Buddha says about mindfulness. Mindfulness is the way to the deathless. Inattentiveness is the way to death. Those who are diligently attentive do not die. Those who are thoughtless are as if dead already. There's a lot packed into that. So mindfulness is just, mindful of what? Mindful how? I just want to unpack that a little bit and hopefully give us some practices to go home with. Because, you know, I was having a discussion with my friend, Reverend Michael Gott, the other day, and he said, you know, sometimes we speak from our mastery and sometimes we speak from our growing edge. I'm here to tell you, this is not mastery today. This is a growing edge, being mindful. And I have some practices that are working really well for me that I've sustained long term, and daily I forget a million times and remember five, maybe. And my goal is to remember six, okay? It's a process. It's a practice. That's why they call it practice. Practice makes progress. How many times are you going to fall for that same one? It's like the third time I've tried that on you guys. Yeah. It's the way to get to Carnegie Hall. Practice, practice, practice. It's the way to get to mindfulness. If we are closed to the now of our lives, no matter how busy we are, no matter how much we have going on, if we are closed to the now, then we are not really living. And we talk a lot about mindfulness in meditation, which is great, but it's kind of like Buddha under the Bodhi tree. If we are completely mindful for 20, 30 minutes, an hour, once a day, twice a day, but then when we get up from our meditation cushion and go out into the world, we lose it all. What good is it? I mean, it's restorative for us, but it doesn't really create much good in the rest of the world. So the first thing that I would say is, instead of thinking that I need to meditate more, is that I need to make whatever I am doing my meditation. And that's what mindfulness is. Mindfulness in your work. I have made a practice for some time I don't know exactly why I chose this one task, but when I unload the dishwasher, I am there with every plate, with every spoon, with every fork, with every cup. And it is, it's a time, because I think it's because of a chore, it's a chore I hate so much that I decided this would be a good one to practice on. And I've been doing it for years. And one of the things it's done, it's really taken the resentment away from how everybody packed the dishwasher wrong. And the things that I have to put back in because they're not clean, and I'm just kind of like, oh, well, here we go again, soak it in some water. And I'm able to be mindful. And that is my unloading the dishwasher becomes a meditation. You can do this. Mowing the lawn can be a meditation. I mean, you're basically sort of, you're drawing, you could be drawing a labyrinth with your lawnmower. Pulling up weeds. I had a good friend, she's no longer with us, but she used to say that she loved to pull weeds because she would be with them and would imagine that she was plucking out rooted sorrows. Plucking out rooted sorrows. Getting rid of them. Take a walk. This is my practice when I walk. It's harder to do when you're walking with someone, but when I walk by myself, I say, reveal yourself to me. Over and over in my head, reveal yourself to me. Reveal yourself to me. Otherwise, if I don't do that, if I don't have that mantra, I will create my laundry list. I will remember all the things and have like shame flashes and guilt for the things that I haven't done yet, and I will be planning on what I need to do next, and I will shorten my walk because I don't have time to walk. I need to get back home and get on this stuff. This mantra is not about, God, please show yourself to me. This is about the universe. This is about every single atom in the universe. If you have something to show me, reveal it. And I see the most marvelous things when I am walking that I would still get the exercise, but I would not see if I were making my laundry list while I was walking. That's a simple way of mindfulness. It's just being there. Another practice I want to give you is, and this is really, really helpful because I think I like to practice when it's the most annoying thing in your life. When you're in line at the grocery store and you inevitably pick the longest line, you know, price check on aisle 3. I have begun to actually look at the people around me, to be present to them, and to, in my mind, without doing anything or saying anything, extend them my compassion. Just know that I don't know their stories. That this lady that's really bugging me in front of me, I don't know her story. She may have barely made it to the grocery store. There's not one of us who doesn't deserve compassion from all the others of us. And just to take that time to be, I call it praying for them, but I'm not saying, you know, dear God, please make this, but it's not that. I'm just extending my compassion and my awareness. I'm seeing them. I'm seeing them for that moment. And that helps me not get so mad about having to stand in line for another 5 minutes. And I do that to show you that that's the way I have stood in line a lot of my life. And I don't know if it does them any good, but it's done me a whole lot of good. So there is a meditation technique that I'm going to take you through in a little while, but it's from Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a Vietnamese monk, a Buddhist monk, and it's simply this: breathing in, I know I am breathing in. Breathing out, I know I am breathing out. And it's a way of being present with the breath every moment. I'm doing nothing but breathing in. I'm doing nothing but breathing out. I am here. I'm present with my breath. It just slows it down. And that's really what mindfulness is. It slows down the mind. And the miracle of it is that it doesn't necessarily slow down the activity. It actually can make me more efficient when I'm not, you know, tripping over potted plants and forgetting where my keys are, you know, and having to run around the house a million times to find them. So being with the work, being wherever you are, being where your hands are. If you're washing dishes, be with the dishes. Try not to be somewhere else. If you're brushing your teeth. So that's mindfulness in whatever our activities are. Another way of being mindful, and this is a place where I really have a lot of work to do, and it's to be being mindful of our physical beings. What does it feel like to be in this body? Where and how am I moving? Are my shoulders up like this? Am I hunched over? Am I, you know, where? What am I doing? How am I feeling? How does it feel? Be alert. Notice your body in space. You know, I love to watch ballet dancers. I just think that's incredible that they actually know where they're going to land. Or maybe even more balletic is a football receiver that's standing right by the boundary, and the football's coming, and he's leaning out to get it, but somehow he's able to keep his toes in boundaries so he can make the catch. I am just fascinated by that every time I see it, because I don't know where my feet are. I've probably stepped on the feet of many of you, because I don't know where they are a lot of the time. I'm not with my body. A good deal of time, I'm here, and I'm not with my body. So mindfulness in my work, in my activity, helps me to be aware of my body. But, you know, what hurts? What feels alive? I've managed to have injuries in my life that I made much worse because I ignored them. And, you know, we can go into all kinds of family of origin things about why that might be true, but the point is I ignored it until it got worse, and then the mend was a more drastic measure than it would have been if I had been able to go, wow, something's wrong here. Something's wrong here. Mindfulness in the body is something I think could really help anybody who wants to lose weight be able to do that. I don't think that anybody's overweight because they enjoy their food too much. I think most of the time we don't enjoy it. Our mind is somewhere else. And so we just keep eating it without even knowing that we're eating it. Being mindful of actually chewing and being aware of the taste and the texture and the experience of the bite, and then being aware of our body telling us that was enough. Have you ever just looked down and you have an empty bag of chips in your hand and you have no idea how that happened? Did you really enjoy those? That is the difference between mindfulness and mindlessness in our bodies. And then the other thing, I just love Pema Chodron. Anybody read any of her books? She is a Canadian Tibetan Buddhist monk. And she writes lovely, lovely books on basically they're all on mindfulness in some way. But she talks about this concept of leaning into the sharp points, of being aware of something that maybe is uncomfortable, and instead of immediately going, whoa, whoa, not that. I'm getting away from that as quickly as I can. Actually just taking a moment to lean into it and see what it feels like. And that goes for emotional pain, and I've had that where it's just like, wait a minute, instead of running from this, what if I just feel what this feels like? Because a lot of times what I find is that immediately the pain of it is not as bad as my dread of the pain of it. And the longer I continue to dread it and not experience it, the longer I carry it with me. And when I'm able to experience it is when I can begin to let it go. But also in the body, you know, am I cold? Putting on a jacket. Am I hot? Turning down the air conditioner. You know, sometimes I just go, oh, wow, I'm really hot. How does this feel? Is it really that bad? And until about July 14th, it's not really that bad. And about, you know, somewhere toward the end of July, I go, oh, yeah, it's that bad. And then I run and just air condition everything all the time. But you know, just taking a moment. Sometimes we don't even know what it is we're reacting to. I go to the refrigerator because I think I'm hungry. Am I hungry or am I sad and I want to make myself feel better? Or am I hungry and I'm really tired and what I need more than a food to pick me up is a little bit of rest to pick me up? Just paying attention, just being where I am. And then there's mindfulness in relationships. And I'm going to share another practice of Thich Nhat Hanh. Which is just beautiful. He calls this his four mantras of relationship that he says can transform any relationship in your life. Because he considers the greatest gift that you can give another human being anytime, ever, whoever it is your presence. And how often are we in the same room with someone that we're not present to? It's very difficult to be present, completely present to someone. And he says this, is his first mantra, darling, I am here for you. And that just means I see you, I hear you, I'm sorry. The gift of presence. The first one is just, I'm here. I'm not anywhere else. I'm in this room. I'm in front of you. I'm with you. In this moment, here I am. And then the next mantra is, darling, I know you are here. I see you. I hear you. I'm actually seeing you and not just seeing the story I made up in my head about you at some point in our relationship. I see you and I can hear you and I feel your presence. I feel that you're present with me. And the next mantra is, darling, I know that you suffer. Meaning, I will listen to you. I am willing to be present in the face of your suffering and not try to fix it, not run away from it, not try to make myself feel more comfortable, but be with you in the presence of your suffering. I will hold it. And then the last one is, darling, I suffer. Meaning, I am willing to show you my vulnerability. I'm willing to let you in and share my suffering with you instead of turning away and hiding it. And that is so healing. I have done this. I don't do it all the time, once every 5 years, maybe. But when we really can slow down enough, or we are awake enough to realize that it's important, this is something that I studied a lot, you know, in seminary. They make you go deep. It's not just learning about stuff. You have to like really look in here and learn about stuff in here, which is much harder than learning about stuff in a book. And one of the things that I realize is that in my busyness, that I am often not completely present with the people that I love. I'm thinking about my next thing to do. And I have missed times when someone, and I'm a good listener. If you say to me, Melinda, I really need you to listen to me. Will you pray with me? Will you sit down with me? I am so good at listening. But if we just happen to be walking along and you happen to start talking, I might miss that you are telling me something very important. And when I realized that about myself, it kind of broke my heart. And I made a vow that I don't want to do that anymore. I want to be available to what there is to hear, to what there is to listen to. And it's hard. I'm sure I still do it, but I work on it. I work on being available and awake and present. And that is the gift. And in mindfulness, in that moment, there's no judgment, there's no resentment. My other mindfulness practice is this: I choose, I love. I choose, I love. Meaning, here I am doing these dishes again, okay? I chose to be with the person I'm with who does not do dishes well, if he does them at all. I chose this kitchen. I chose these dishes. I chose this home. I chose to have dinner tonight. And so I actually love all this stuff. I just think I don't because I'm not paying attention. I chose it. I love it. I chose it, I love it. And if you're mindful enough to know that you chose it and you do not love it, then that is information. And I also have those moments. I chose this. Okay, yeah, I have no one to blame but myself. How can I get out of this? How can I not do this anymore if it's not serving me or if it's not serving in general? And the gifts that mindfulness always, in my experience, always leads to gratitude. Always, always, always. Because I'm telling you, you are showered. You and I are showered with blessings every moment of every day that we do not see because we are somewhere else besides where we actually are. And so increasing your mindfulness by 1% brings such, it doesn't bring more blessings, it makes you able to take in those blessings that are already there. And that leads to gratitude. And gratitude opens that even another percentage point. And that brings in more blessing. And we get into this flow. So just really quickly to wrap up, what mindfulness is not, it's not noticing in the present moment what someone else should be doing to make me happier. It is not being annoyed that my dog needs to go out because I'm trying to write a sermon and this is very important. It is, I love this dog and she needs to go out. How about if I'm actually with her for a minute instead of going, you know, get outside. What if I just go, hey, thanks for the break from the sermon writing, let's go outside. It is not making mental lists of how I want to be more mindful tomorrow. And it's not telling myself stories that make me feel better or denying what's really going on or ignoring or redefining a situation that makes me uncomfortable. It's about being in the situation, but it's also not judging that situation. It's not saying, oh, I'm mindful, this sucks. It's about, I'm mindful, let me be with it and see what the truth of it is and see what wisdom and love that Tim said earlier have to show me about it. And I suspect mindfulness can lead to different things for different people or can be different things for different people. I know I use this as an example for a lot, but Bob has big shoulders. He can take it. I love my husband. We've been together for over 26 years, and we get along really pretty well. And I adore him, and he adores me. And at least 6 times a day, I could knock his block off. Because I like order. I crave order. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I like things to be a certain way. And he is a complete slob. He doesn't even know. It's not that he's doing it on purpose. He's like, oh, is there dog poop on my shoes? I didn't know. After he's tracked it around the whole house. So we were talking about this the other day, and that for him, mindfulness might be noticing that, wow, there's really a mess around here. And how does that make me feel? And maybe I will want to do something about it in a mindful way. For me, sometimes mindfulness is noticing the mess around me and being willing to sit with how uncomfortable it makes me feel instead of immediately jumping up and pushing things into order. Mindfulness is not squirrel. It's not multitasking. I'm being present to this, I'm being present to this, I'm being present to this. It kind of is about one thing at a time. But I tell you, it does increase your efficiency in my experience, in my limited experience, okay? And it's not about doing it right. Don't use trying a mindfulness practice as an excuse to beat yourself up because you're not practicing well enough. This is hard. This is hard stuff, and it's stuff that brings great reward. And finally, the Buddha said, work out your own salvation with diligence. And I just love that, because salvation to Buddha just meant being awake. No one can give you your awakeness. They can ring the bell, open the curtains, turn on the lights, pull back the covers, but only you can choose to awaken. But to awaken is possible for everyone. And the reason I wanted to talk about this today is just that it kind of works. It actually has a place in my life. When I am here now, you know, there are things I worry about. There are things I regret. There are all this. But I am here. What happens is here we are. We are in this room. We are nowhere else. Those things may need to be handled, but here we are. And I want joy now, not somewhere in the future. I want healing now, not sometime in the future. I want tools that make my life work better for me and for those around me. And for me, mindfulness is one of those tools. And now I'm going to take this practice into some meditation. So just breathe. And be where you are. If your feet are on the floor, feel what your feet feel like inside your shoes. What do your legs feel like? What does your rear end feel like in the chair? How does your back feel? Is it straight? Are you leaning back? Are you leaning forward? Does it hurt? And breathe deeply. How does it feel when you fill your body with breath, when you actually take the time to fill your lungs completely instead of taking those little shallow, I got something to do breaths that we tend to take? Feel your shoulders. Are they carrying burdens that you have forgotten you even had? Feel your arms, your elbows, your wrists, your hands, your fingers. What do they feel like? And feel your neck, which is so strong. It carries this heavy, heavy thing. Heavy physically and figuratively. Your head. How does your head feel? Your face, your eyes, your lips, your nose, your ears. Can you feel hair on the back of your neck? Are you noticing that you feel the air conditioner on the back of your neck? And let's just breathe. And take long, slow breaths and just do this with me in your mind, breathing in. I know I am breathing in. And then pause and then exhale with breathing out. I know I am breathing out. You are here now. By divine appointment, there is no other place for you to be in this moment. In this moment, there is no time, there is no space, there is only this moment. In this moment, there is no death. In this moment, I invite you to allow the idea that you choose, I choose, we choose. And on the heels of that, you love, I love, we love. We choose, and it's our responsibility to notice that we've chosen and to love what we choose. And if we're present with what we've chosen and we can't find love for it, then possibly we need to make another choice. There's no judgment in that. There's no wrong. There's no right. There's just information. But it's information that we tend to ignore or deny when we're always in the last moment or the next moment. In this moment, I breathe in and I know I'm breathing in. I breathe out and I know I'm breathing out. And I know that who I am and where I am right now is my choice. And I make the choice to open my heart to love what is. only through truly seeing what is and loving what is can we move forward with any wisdom into what's next. If you're already at what's next before you get to what is, you've missed the bus. So the good things, the things we judge as good, what is, being with one single segment of a tangerine while you chew it, rather than quickly putting segment after segment into your mouth. Or something we label as bad, like being angry at someone we love. Just sit with that for a minute and have the feeling without necessarily getting up and yelling. Or deciding that that moment of anger means something larger than just a moment of anger. We choose. But the choice is only truly ours if we are awake enough to make a conscious choice. So my prayer for all of us today, for myself, surely, for every one of you and for every sentient being, is that we have enough awakeness to love and to choose consciously. Even if it's just one extra tiny atom per day, the joy that we bring to our lives, the peace that we bring into the world, the compassion that we're able to show for ourselves and others increases exponentially with our ability to be where we are. And for this teaching, I'm very grateful.